Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripinchuk. On today's show, we'll hear two Chicago presentations on the topic of American foreign policy by Chicago activists Robert Nayman and Andy Thayer. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Pentagon officials were forced to admit they hired a PR firm to produce secret background profiles of journalists seeking to cover the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan following an investigation by the Stars and Stripes newspaper, a daily published for U.S. service members in 48 countries. The military now has terminated its contract with the Rendon Group, which prepared the summaries for military public affairs officials. The journalists were rated positive, negative, or neutral based on their likelihood of giving the military friendly coverage. Kevin Barron is one of the reporters who broke the story.
And at the bottom of some of these reports would then go on to suggest whether or not that reporter would be susceptible to good news kind of coverage if given the right opportunities, you know, or if they were the kind of reporter who got a lot of negative ratings, then perhaps they could be neutralized with a different kind of coverage and opportunities.
That the Pentagon compiles information on journalists is nothing new. A vetting process for any journalist looking to embed with the military is certainly necessary. But what the Rendon Group was doing went far beyond the initial vision of the embed program. It tied the media analysis to the denial or approval of a journalist's request. The analysis wasn't being used as a way to screen whether the applicant was a good reporter in terms of accuracy and writing skill, but whether the reporter would write good news about the military.
The Army has rules for this embed system that was created when these wars started in the previous administration. And written right into it says that in no way is this system designed to prevent bad news or embarrassing news about the military to get out. This is supposed to be the military's way of facilitating journalism of the war, of making it happen, getting reporters where they need to be, making sure everybody's safe, all that kind of stuff. It's not supposed to have anything to do with being a way to spin the war, to control reporters, to direct them where to go, anything like that.
Yet journalists who want to cover the U.S. military in a war zone can't get access unless they embed with the troops.
You know, there's a lot of new journalists who are trying to get into Afghanistan now. There's new fighting going on. It's a renewed story. It's getting into the winter. There's going to be more demand for this, not less. And so the more hiccups in this system that we hear about, the more they're going to start to mount up. And, you know, we'll see how smoothly things go.
Barron says that the Stars and Stripes investigation of the embedded journalist program will continue.
Internet marketers gather information from virtually every click we make online, where we go, what we watch, and what we buy. They compile the data for what is called behavioral advertising, ads targeted specifically for you. Privacy watchdogs have long warned that too much of this information is being gathered without our knowledge. Now Congress might be stepping in. Rick Boucher of Virginia, the chairman of the House Commerce Committee, is drafting a bill that would impose new rules for how websites and marketers ensure user privacy and safety. Last week, a coalition of consumer advocates and privacy groups called on Congress and the Federal Trade Commission to create a system that's transparent, accountable, and has meaningful consumer rights, especially when it comes to privacy. Susan Grant is the director of consumer protection at the Consumer Federation of America. She wants marketers and websites to stop collecting sensitive information.
Sensitive information like somebody's race, ethnicity, their sexual orientation, their political activity, and other very personal information shouldn't be collected and used for behavioral advertising at all. Some in Congress feel that it would be okay to collect that kind of information as long as the consumer opted in, that is, affirmatively agreed to it. We're saying that that information should be off limits, period, because the potential for abuse is just too great.
Abuse could be in the form of what is called digital redlining, which could impact obtaining credit or accessing government benefits, educational opportunities, or insurance.
information about consumers would be compiled to profile them and then perhaps offer one person goods or services at less advantageous terms or of lower quality than another person based on that profile.
And there are other concerns about how information gathered by this type of internet spying can be used.
We're also concerned about the possibility for information to be stolen by identity thieves, for information and profiles to be used by the government, for instance, to try to find people who may fit the profile that they think exists of terrorists or other uses way beyond that of advertising.
Grant's first priority for an online behavioral tracking and targeting bill is to make sure marketers and websites can't collect information unless users opt in to the data mining process. She would also like to see the Federal Trade Commission create a Do Not Track registry, similar to the Do Not Call registry. For more information about online tracking, go to consumerfed.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. We now feature two Chicago presentations on the topic of American foreign policy by Chicago activists Robert Naiman and Andy Thayer. Both presentations were part of the Peace Panel at the 2009 conference of the Illinois Coalition of Justice, Peace, and the Environment, recorded on Saturday, April 18, 2009. The first presentation features Robert Naiman, senior policy analyst at Just Foreign Policy, speaking on Four Principles for Peace in Afghanistan.
So I want to talk about Afghanistan, and in particular, of course, U.S. policy towards Afghanistan. I assume that everyone here is against the continued U.S. military occupation of Afghanistan and wants to bring that to an end as quickly as possible. So, indeed, but we are there, and so the question that we face now is how to get out. So what I wanted to address is what are the ideas that the intermediate steps, so of course there is in Washington very little discussion of getting out, but also very little discussion even of the intermediate steps that would lead to getting out. So what I want to talk about is the intermediate steps. What are the ideas that we could try and get into the political debate in the United States that would start to point us in the direction of getting out? And I think there are three key things, actually. The first is pushing the United States government to support negotiations with insurgent leaders in Afghanistan without preconditions. So there's actually three things there. First of all, negotiations. Historically, the position of the U.S. Has been, we support reconciliation in Afghanistan. What they have meant by that in practice has been amnesty, kind of amnesty for low-level insurgent fighters, Taliban fighters, who agree to put down their arms and support the Afghan government and the Afghan constitution. I have no dispute with this. As far as it goes, it's a wonderful thing, but it just doesn't go very far. The record shows, the common sense would indicate, this hasn't ended the insurgency. This process has removed a few people from combat who were quickly replaced by other people. So this kind of quote-unquote reconciliation is not going to end the insurgency. And these conditions have a lot to be set against them. There's no reason to have any preconditions at all, but in particular, no reason for preconditions for talks or negotiations. But in particular, these preconditions don't make sense. First of all, the condition of laying down weapons in the context of Afghanistan, certainly many parts of Afghanistan, asking male adults to lay down their weapons is kind of like asking male adults in rural Kentucky to lay down their weapons. It's not very popular. And, you know, we might not agree that male adults should be armed as a matter of course, either in rural Kentucky or rural Afghanistan. But this is the culture, this is the custom, and it's important to recognize that in the Afghan context, in many people, this is a ridiculous demand. Of course, we're not going to give up our weapons. So regardless of what you think of that, it's a ridiculous precondition for negotiations or talks. That folks should support the Afghan government. You know, even Western diplomats, quoted not by name in articles in the U.S. press, are constantly disparaging the Afghan government that has been put in place by the Western powers. I don't endorse all those criticisms. Some of them are clearly self-interested. You know, the Afghan government does something that the Western powers don't like, then they undermine it. Sometimes the Afghan government says worthy things, like there should be a timetable for the withdrawal of Western military forces from the country, or the Western military forces should stop killing so many Afghan civilians. Nonetheless, it's, again, absurd as a precondition for talks and negotiations. These preconditions weren't imposed by the United States when it got serious about negotiations with insurgent groups in Iraq. Didn't demand that the Sunni Arab insurgents lay down their weapons. Didn't demand that they recognize or support the Iraqi government or the Iraqi constitution. So these are just artificial, arbitrary roadblocks to talks and negotiations. They're unnecessary and counterproductive, and prevent talks from going forward or from being serious. So, so negotiations also means that you're actually willing to talk about political stuff. The United States and Iraq had a political dialogue with part of the Sunni Arab insurgency. This part that they had to talk with, they had political demands. And the United States agreed to talk about those political demands and even adopt some of those political demands. So, for example, one of their political demands was we want to be integrated into the Iraqi security forces, the police and the army. And the United States took that demand on board. So, the, you know, how they followed that through is another question. You could agree or disagree that that was a good idea. But my point is that when the United States decided to get serious about dealing with part of the Sunni Arab insurgency in Iraq, they were willing to talk about political things. And with leaders, I said negotiations with insurgent leaders without preconditions. The focus of U.S. Reconciliation in the past has been, well, we'll take these low-level, we'll deal with these low-level guys. But again, that's not what the United States did in Iraq. It talked to leaders. And of course, that's how you politically end an insurgency. You talk to the people that are in charge of it. Like, you don't just talk to the foot soldiers. You talk to the leaders. You talk to the political forces that are promoting the insurgency. So this is a key thing that's missing so far. The Obama administration officials have made some gestures in the direction of saying, you know, we understand there's no military solution, we understand at the end of the day there's going to be a political resolution that's going to involve talks with insurgents, which, by the way, are already taking place. There are already a process of talks between the Afghan government, Afghan parliamentarians, and representatives of Afghan insurgencies. So it's not a question of, you know, whether there can be talks. It's a question of whether the United States will support these talks and allow these talks to succeed. And one of the things that's key is putting on the table for discussion things that only the United States controls. So the United States and its friends, mainly the United States, the United States decides whether there'll be airstrikes. The United States decides whether there'll be night raids by special operations forces. Two very controversial things that the United States is doing in Afghanistan in terms of Afghan public opinion with the high level of casualties. These are things that the Afghan government has complained about, would like to get rid of, but the United States is keeping them off the table for discussion. These things would have to be on the table for discussion if there were to be a genuine agreement to end the insurgency. So this is the first thing. First and arguably most important thing. The United States should support talks between Afghan government and the leaders of Afghan insurgencies without preconditions. The second thing is that the United States needs to start talking about getting out. What's the long term is? Are we there forever? Are we having permanent military bases? Are we having a permanent military garrison in Afghanistan? Or are we willing to talk about a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. military forces from Afghanistan? Now we have a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. military forces in Iraq. Why not in Afghanistan? Why should not a timetable be on the table for discussion as part of negotiations with the Afghan insurgents? And this is something that Congress could be doing in the current supplemental. Three members of Congress have written to President Obama demanding a timetable for the redeployment of U.S. military forces from Afghanistan. That should be 30, and then it should be 60, and then it should be 200. That's something that could be happening now in the context of the supplemental. And the final thing is regional diplomacy. Now, at the level of broad level of abstraction, you get lots of people to say that regional diplomacy is a good thing, and the Obama administration has actually done some positive, made some positive beginnings in that direction. We're talking to Iran. Iran, and of course, was stupid not to talk to Iran about Afghanistan before, but now we are. The Iranian police chief has announced that Iran is ready to train police in Afghanistan. That's all, you know, good as far as it goes. But the key thing that's missing from this picture so far is discussions between the United States, India, and Pakistan about the relationship between India and Pakistan and the role of the India-Pakistan conflict in Afghanistan, something that's been acknowledged by Obama administration officials. In particular, if India and Pakistan would resume their peace talks and lower their escalation, particularly over this issue of Kashmir, this would do a lot to changing the dynamics in Pakistan, which U.S. officials are now saying openly, what they hinted in the past, that elements of the Pakistani state are directly supporting, financing, assisting, advising insurgent groups in Afghanistan. If you agree with that, if you believe that, you think that that's a serious problem, then the logical thing to do is to address the motivations of those elements of the Pakistani state in doing that. According to U.S. officials, the motivations of those elements of the Pakistani state is that they see this as part of their national self-defense strategy against India. Figure the U.S. is leaving Afghanistan eventually, and we don't want to see Afghanistan become a client state of India. We want to maintain our influence in Afghanistan. Again, regardless of what you think about that, a rational person acting on a rational basis would try to figure out, trying to change the behavior of those folks in Pakistan. You could, you know, lobby them to do something that they believe to be fundamentally against their self-interest, or you could negotiate with them and try to bring them into a process that meets their interests in a different way. And that's something that the United States has failed to do so far. As a result, in part, by pushback from India. So putting the issue of Kashmir on the table for discussion between the United States, Pakistan, and India, even without resolving it in the short term, there's lots that India and Pakistan could do to lower the temperature, intermediate things to lower the temperature of the conflict over Kashmir, and those are things that the United States should be pushing for, and those are things that Congress should be talking about. So two key things that I hope in the coming weeks people will be talking to Congress and their staff about. Putting on the table a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. military forces from Afghanistan, putting on the table U.S. support for negotiations between the Afghan government and leaders of Afghanistan's insurgencies without preconditions. Thank you.
That was Robert Naiman. The next presentation features Andy Thayer, co-founder of the Gay Liberation Network and an organizer with the Chicago Coalition Against War and Racism, speaking on organizing against Obama's wars.
Organizing against Obama's wars, that's the topic I chose for myself today. And I deliberately made it provocative because I think we need to come to terms with the current situation that we're facing. Anyone who attended the demonstrations around the country on the sixth anniversary of the Iraq invasion knows that the attendance was down all around the country. And it was not just the anniversary demonstrations, but all anti-war demonstrations over the past several months the attendance has been down. We need to come to terms with that and investigate what it means for our movement, because if anything, we're farther away from the kind of, not just attendance at demonstrations, but real social pressure that is the only way that we can end these wars. And it is tragic that we're farther away from where we need to be today than we were, say, maybe a couple of years ago. And looking back at the history of the Vietnam War movement, even though my hat's off to those of you who are active at that time, that you did, for example, prevent Richard Nixon from nuking North Vietnam, and that was a gain. You know, it's horrible, though, that that war went on for year after year after year, killing, was it 3 million Vietnamese alone? And anyone who is certainly a member of that movement, I'm sure, thinks to themselves, damn it, if we could only have ended that war earlier. What a tragedy that we were unable to do that. And unfortunately, we are in danger of repeating that very tragic history. Just six years since the Iraq invasion, not to mention, of course, the Afghanistan invasion, which many of us, I'm happy to say, opposed right from the get-go. I think everyone who did so deserves a pat on the back, because we know how difficult it was in late September of 2001 to oppose that impending war, and how many people that should have known better did not. But let me fast forward to the present. Over the past 6-7 years, the Iraq War has been referred to over and over again, with some justification, as George Bush's war. And that was a very useful propaganda point. The point is that it is now Barack Obama's war, Barack Obama's occupations, and we need to start calling them that. But beyond that, we need to point to the point that these are not just this or that individual president's war, but there is a system behind it, that this is a system that gives rise to war, and our current president is pushing forward those wars even more ably, arguably, than his predecessor. And that's a tragedy. That's a tragedy that many of the people in our movement are not calling him up. I was listening to a commentary the other day that was critical of Barack Obama. It was from the left. It was talking about, well, this is awful, these wars and so forth, that kept on referring to him as a peace candidate. And I said, my God, are we so stuck in our pre-campaign rhetoric that we're referring to a man as a peace candidate who's leading a surge into Afghanistan, who's responsible for the displacement, thanks to the escalation of the war into Pakistan, a displacement of perhaps over a million, perhaps over 2 million Pakistanis? Are we seriously talking about this guy as a peace candidate? Not to mention, of course, the latest budget, which of course has an increase in the military budget. This amidst the most serious economic depression, recession, whatever the hell you want to call it, since the last one in the 1930s, and yet barely a peep. No discussion. I mean, we had to leave it up practically to our right-wing friends on tax day to talk about the spending. Of course, they had no problem about the military spending, but where was the left on that? Where was the left on that? We have a so-called peace president now who, reject the notion that there could be a peace president, but just for the sake of fantasy for a moment, let's just say we've got one or could conceivably have a peace president. If we had a peace president, he'd be talking about ending all aid to Israel immediately unless it cut off the settlements, removed all the settlements in the West Bank, removed the apartheid wall, stopped the siege of Gaza, and also publicly forswore the notion of bombing Iran. But of course, our current peace president himself said he would bomb Iran if need be. So much for that. The tragedy is that the longer our movement does this, the longer we provide political cover to a man who was our opponent. A much smarter opponent than the last one, mind you. Some of us might argue also considerably cuter, but that's another issue. The point is that he is our opponent, and we need to start talking about him as such. And unfortunately, there's plenty of historical precedent for doing the wrong thing on this issue. I'm not old enough to remember, but I'm told that in the run-up to LBJ's first election, the peace movement took on the notion of half the way with LBJ, that we will, this is someone we can work with as opposed to his Republican opponent. And we saw where that left us. It delayed the start of a serious opposition to the Vietnam War, arguably the failure of the left in this country to call out the warmongers on both sides of the aisle, led to a lengthening of that war and many more Southeast Asian people dead as a result. In terms of my personal experience, I know that in terms of the movement in the gay community, we had a great movement going under the first George Bush. We had a serious movement in the streets in the form of ACT UP in the most desperate sort of circumstances possible because the rest of the left was crumbling, and yet we had this bright spot of ACT UPs that were demanding real change, and we got some real change in the form of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Ryan White AIDS Care Act, and in terms of the speeding up the FDA drug process for anti-AIDS drugs. We won some real things in the face of a very nasty George Bush the First regime. But when George Clinton came into town, it was not Bill Clinton, George Clinton, sorry. See where I'm going with this. When Bill Clinton came into town, we had a tragic thing that happened to our gay movement. All the ACT UPs pretty much rolled up shop. We got things like Defense of Marriage Act. We got things like Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We got things like the president rejecting all of the recommendations of his AIDS panel. And we actually stepped backwards in the course of a democratic regime. And you can see this in terms of Bill Clinton's regime in a whole number of ways. The death penalty being fast-tracked, so the people like Mumia Abu-Jamal face the very real possibility of the death penalty. We face things like the ending of welfare as we know, and a whole host of other tragic losses because the left would not take on the Democratic Party. So, let me move forward to the present. We need to call things by their right name. And one of them is that Barack Obama needs to be opposed as steadfastly as his predecessors, that this is a system that we are fighting. And when you have a situation of economic competition tends to grow over into military competition. The United States is in the Middle East because it wants to control the world's oil, and control of the world's oil means domination of the rest of the planet well into this century. And that's what they're aiming with this, and Barack Obama is serving that. Finally, two finally things. If the left fails to do this, politics abhors a vacuum. We have already seen that the right wing can make hay out of the economic crisis. And if the left, in the interest of not opposing, quote unquote, our president, our candidate, whatever, abstains on these issues, the right wing will fill the void. And they'll fill the void with much nastier politics. There is a real possibility of serious right wing populist politics today, not only because there is a massive economic crisis on, but it's very easy for them when the Democrats are in the office. I mean, look at how Rush Limbaugh et al. got their start. They got their start, really, during the administration of Bill Clinton, and we've got a real danger of that. And it was evidenced on the tax day demonstrations right around the country. My right-wing brother and sister-in-law down in Austin, Texas, who never participate in politics at all, they were down at that piece of crap that they had down there in Austin. I'm sure there were many other people like them. If the left abstains on taking on this president about the wars, about the bailouts of the banks and so forth, the right wing will fill the void, and we will all be paying the price for that, because in economic times like this, the chances for right-wing lunatics getting a hearing for their scapegoating is much more serious and dangerous, and it's one who's a member of the gay community. I can see that happening right now to particularly Latinos and immigrants. We're already seeing the deportations. And so if we abstain on these issues, we abstain at our peril. Final thing, just on the issue of Afghanistan, frankly, I must respectfully disagree with you, Bob. The whole notion that the United States or any of its proxies has got the right to negotiate over another nation's future, I find abhorrent and arrogant. And I know that there was a history of this same debate in the anti-Vietnam War movement where people talk about, well, let's provide the more reasonable alternative. Let's say we're for negotiations and whatever, guys. The United States does not have the right to dictate another nation's future, full stop. The only thing the United States has got the right to do is get out immediately.
That was Andy Thayer. The full audio of the 2009 conference of the Illinois Coalition for Justice, Peace, and the Environment is available online at www.icjpe.org. That's ICJPE for the Illinois Coalition for Justice, Peace, and the Environment.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.